So we can move on to the next item on the agenda, which is accounting for COVID-19 rent concessions. And I give the floor probably to Petrina.
You're actually going to give it to Catherine.
Oh, Catherine. All right.
Thank you, Hans.
Our multitasker. Yes, okay.
So I'm going to tee up agenda paper 32B, which, as Hans said, discusses COVID-19 related rent concessions applying IFRS 16. Now, I'm going to state from the outset that this paper contains an unusual set of staff proposals, and that is really in response to the fact that our stakeholders are currently facing an exceptional set of circumstances. What I'm going to do is first summarise the issue up for discussion this morning and then share some more high-level thoughts on the unusual nature of what we're asking the board to do. So the issue relates to rent concessions provided to lessees during the COVID-19 pandemic. In some cases, those concessions are a straight forgiveness of lease payments, and in other cases, a lessee might make no payments for, say, 3 months now, but make increased payments in future, or have an additional 3 months added on to the end of the current contract. We understand those rent concessions are occurring or are expected to occur in high volumes and across many IFRS jurisdictions as a result of the pandemic. Now, IFRS 16 already tells companies how to account for these situations. The problem, however, is that applying the requirements to a potentially large volume of COVID-19 related rent concessions could be practically difficult, and that is especially true for lessees. They need to assess each rent concession to determine whether it is an IFRS 16 lease modification, and if it is, they then need to remeasure the lease liability, which includes determining a new discount rate. To be clear, that accounting is not normally unduly onerous. The problem at the moment is the high volume of concessions coupled with the many other challenges companies are facing during the pandemic. We're therefore recommending that the board provide lessees only with an optional practical expedient whereby they are not required to assess whether COVID-19 related rent concessions are lease modifications, and instead account for those concessions on the assumption that they are not lease modifications. The accounting that results from that assumption is not new. It is already covered in IFRS 16. It already applies to changes in lease payments that are not lease modifications. And in practical terms, it is simpler than modification accounting. We're recommending that the practical expedient be tightly scoped in the way described in paragraph 31 of the paper, so that it can be applied only to rent concessions that arise as a result of COVID-19, only to rent concessions for which any reduction in lease payments occurs during 2020, and only to rent concessions that are not combined with any other changes to the lease contract. So on to a few very important points about our proposal. We're only making this recommendation having concluded that it is possible to provide a simple, tightly ring-fenced and helpful option to companies that doesn't carry a substantial risk of unintended consequences and would still result in useful information for users. The recommendation represents a limited departure from IFRS 16 that is intended only to help stakeholders at this difficult time. We anticipate that the circumstances leading to this recommendation are to be extremely rare, and indeed, we do not anticipate in making similar recommendations again. Our recommendation will only be of benefit to companies if it is provided in a timely manner and if it is immediately effective on issue. So to be blunt, if the practical expedient is to be useful, then it needs to be provided now. The COVID-19 pandemic is an unpredictable event, and I'm sure every one of us at this meeting could come up with any number of rent concession scenarios that could occur in future. However, we do not think it's helpful to speculate about all of those scenarios or to introduce complexity into the proposed relief. Instead, we're asking the board to tightly scope the proposals to minimise the risk of unintended consequences and to decide whether it is able to provide a simple relief to companies based on the information that it has right now. With that urgency in mind, it's also important to highlight that should you vote in favour of providing a practical expedient, we also recommend that the board asks the IFRS Foundation trustees to approve an unusually short 14-day exposure draft comment period. We'll come on to due process questions later in the meeting, but an important point to keep in mind when considering the technical recommendations in the paper is whether you think stakeholders will have sufficient opportunity to comment on a draft. Now, we are comfortable recommending 14 days for two main reasons. Firstly, the simplicity and tight scoping of the proposed practical expedient, and secondly, because we've already had a relatively high level of stakeholder engagement on this issue, and we know that stakeholders are standing ready to read and respond to an exposure draft. Last but not least, and related to that high level of stakeholder engagement so far, I'd like to highlight a couple of very specific matters about the paper in light of feedback we've received since posting it. So paragraph 31 of the paper contains indicative drafting of our recommended practical expedient, with proposed paragraph YA stating that to qualify for the practical expedient, a rent concession must result in revised consideration for the lease that is the same as or less than the consideration for the lease immediately preceding the change. Now, this is because we do not believe a rent concession should ever increase the consideration for a lease. However, we understand that it is possible to have scenarios in which the effects of the time value of money on a lease holiday provided now and repaid by the lessee could result in small increases to total lease payments, and we would not want that effect to prevent a lessee from being able to apply the practical expedient. Consequently, in drafting, we plan to add the word substantially to this paragraph, such that it would refer to revised consideration that is substantially the same as or less than. We then make clear in the basis the very limited circumstances in which we'd expect that substantially to be relevant, i.e. making clear that it relates only to normal time value of money effects. The other point is that we've also received some questions about the interaction of the proposed amendment with the educational material that we recently published on this same topic and that you can see in Appendix A to the paper. Specifically, stakeholders have asked whether the proposals in the paper would supersede that educational material. And the answer to that question is no, and in fact, the two would complement each other. The practical expedient we're recommending today is optional. The educational material will remain helpful to any lessee that chooses not to apply that practical expedient, and indeed it would remain helpful to any entity applying IFRS 16 to changes that are not within the scope of the practical expedient. So with all of that said, what we'd like to do is ask you to first discuss the technical recommendations in the paper and vote on questions 1 and 2. Only if you agree with the recommendations in questions 1 and 2 will we then move on to the subsequent due process questions. So with that, I will hand over to the board for discussion.
Sue?
Thanks, Catherine, for your tee up. I support the staff recommendation in the paper with the clarification that, Catherine, you added about the amount of the consideration and the change to the wording. And I support the staff recommendation, despite the fact that for me, there's a very high hurdle before we start making standard setting decisions sort of in this difficult environment with so much uncertainty. And it's because for me, there's a very special set of circumstances here. So firstly, I'm pleased you commented on the educational material. I think for many, that should be helpful because I'm hoping that if they look at their contracts, they will be able to conclude they actually don't have a lease modification because of the nature of the changes that have gone on or based on their existing contracts. So that hopefully has already been helpful in its own right. But what this does is it provides an extra layer of operational relief for lessees because they just don't have to look at their contracts really in detail at all to decide whether or not it's a lease modification. And I think that's important here because we've got a group of stakeholders here who were already, you know, burdened, if you like, getting everything done to apply IFRS 16 for the first time. So it's a stressed group of stakeholders already who now have to deal with COVID-19 on top of that. So it's an opportunity for us to provide relief to a group of stakeholders. And the recommendations that the staff have made are very neat in the sense that it's a very simple amendment. It just says, make this assumption you don't have to apply modification accounting and apply the other relevant conditions that are in IFRS 16 already. So it's a very narrow scope, clean form of standard setting. And I think it's particularly important for lessees because of IFRS 16, they've ended up with all of their leases basically on the balance sheet and they've got to adjust carrying amounts. And I distinguish their situation very much from the lessor population because most of them have got operating leases. Even if they have lease modifications, the required accounting is not as difficult as it is for lessees. And we haven't changed their world in the same way that we have for lessees. So I support this because of the nature of the amendment. I think it makes it possible for us to help people in a timely way with a short comment period, which we couldn't do if we were making more fundamental changes to the actual mechanics of the accounting in IFRS 16. But because we're just saying, look at this part of IFRS 16 instead of that part of IFRS 16, it's something that it's feasible to do with a short comment period, which means we can step in quickly and provide support to stakeholders in a way that's very targeted. And because of that sort of set of circumstances, combined with, I think, resulting reporting, which is still useful for investors, I think the cost-benefit trade-off for this unusual situation stacks up for me.
Okay, thank you, Sue. Okay. Anybody else? Jian Chao.
Thank you, Hans. Yeah. First of all, I support staff's proposal. I think this is the issue urgently needed from practice, and it simplified accounting treatment while also still provide useful information for the users. Particularly, I have two observations. One is that if without this simplification, those lessees are required to apply modification of lease approach. So as Catherine said that under this approach, those lessees needed to remeasure the lease liability, particularly they needed to revise the lease payment, future lease payment, to revise the discount rate. So particularly in this interest rate cutting and the low interest rate environment, if they are going to require to their discount rate, so the result will be maybe the lease liability will be significantly higher than they expected. And particularly the reason simply because of the COVID-19 related rent concession. So I don't think it will provide useful information, and particularly it will faithfully represent the real economics. So this is the first. Secondly, from performance reporting perspective, for lessee, of course, they get some rent concession. So it will affect the performance, but how to report it, whether they should be reported in the event, which that's the event of COVID-19, triggers forgiveness of lease payment, or if they are required to apply modification approach, that means that effect of COVID-19 will be deferred to future period, particularly future period, maybe COVID-19 no longer exists, So I think from both reasons, I fully support staff's recommendation. And also I appreciate the two classification Catherine just made. One is about the interrelation between this paper and the education material. Another is the clarification with the actual notion of the consideration. I think it's very useful. In addition, I do have a couple of comments. Maybe I wonder whether Catherine could clarify a little bit further. First is about issue. As you mentioned that the scope first on those COVID-19 related event consumption. Oh, it's about the issue arising from a direct consequence of COVID-19. So how to better understand it? For example, some jurisdictions during the pandemic period of COVID-19, the lessees actually are still paying full amount of the rent to the lessor. That means the lessor did not forgive any rental to the lessee. After COVID-19 pandemic, that means there are no new cases confirmed, or there are very few new cases confirmed. And then the lessees, resume their operation, and the business, come back to normal. And then lessor decided to give some, rent concession, sometimes forgive some rentals, sometimes they give some refund to the money, the original paid during the period, sometimes they give some compensation to the lessees. So I wonder if this kind of situation also meets the criteria here, so-called COVID-19 related rent concession, because this is the after COVID-19 pandemic. So this is the first, I would like you to clarify a little bit further. Second, about clarification about consideration, still about further clarification on consideration. We mentioned a couple of times, it's very important, particularly in paragraph 31YA, because there's some particular condition there. So I wonder that the consideration in paragraph 31YA here, and particularly only refer to the undiscounted cash flows, rather than discounted cash flows. In my understanding, it's referred to the undiscounted cash flows. But there are some specific, you also mentioned sometimes there are some factors of time value issues. For example, in some extreme cases, sometimes the lessor give lessee defer to pay the rental for significant period. For example, maybe more than 1 year or 2 years. So in this case, if considering the time value, the present value of the future lease payment maybe was significantly different from the consideration. So even the whole consideration is same, based on the consideration only referred to the undiscounted cash flows, but the present value will be different. So I'm not sure whether this kind of situation will also, qualify for this first condition. So this is the second one I would like to, to have further clarification. Third one is about the issue, about the better understanding about the paragraph 32 and the example giving in the page 40, particularly with regard to the forgiveness of lease payment. The issue about the exact time of derecognition of part of lease liability and the time of recognition of profits or loss arising from forgiveness of this payment. Example of forgiveness of this payment in page 14. It's not very much clear for me whether the forgiveness 300, that is the total amount of 3 months, each month 100 total. So whether the lessee should recognize the profit and loss 300 immediately in March, or whether the lessee should recognize, you know, 100 in March, 100 in April, 100 in May. So I want you to clarify what exactly the time of derecognition and recognition of that forgiveness of lease payment. Finally, about just a clarification about the deferred lease payment, whether deferred lease payment also include, you know, the deferred or extension of lease terms rather than the, you know, simply deferred lease payment. Sometimes they got, as you mentioned, sometimes lessee got some lease holiday and then they will, you know, lessor will extend the lease term for a couple of months. So whether it's also in, it will also in, be included in as a deferred lease payment. So I just want to, you know, want you to clarify a little bit further about those observations. Thank you very much.
Can I just say something before Catherine speaks?
Yeah.
I think as a general proposition, we need to be careful not to start answering, you know, 20 different questions about the application of the existing requirements in 16, because otherwise we're never going to contain this and we're going to maybe cause more problems than, it's, than we're going to answer. But Catherine?
Thanks, Sue. I will comment on all of your questions, Chinchou. I might try and keep it relatively brief, so do let me know if there's anything additional you need. But with regard to your first question about potential rent concessions that come after the worst of the pandemic, if I may call it that, we were very mindful of that when we were developing the analysis that led to the paper, and that is a large reason why we put the time constraint in, so that it can only be applied to concessions that lead to reductions occurring in 2020. The reason is that, as you know, we do not know how long the pandemic will last. And once the worst of the pandemic is over, if I may call it that, the ongoing economic effects could last a long time and entities could be left having to make very difficult judgments about what is and isn't directly related to COVID-19. We think it is clear that the significant effects of the pandemic are happening now, and we think by ring fencing the relief to 2020, we can take some of the pressure off those difficult judgments, because if lessors are offering rent concessions as a result of the pandemic in the next few months, we believe that would be clear between the parties that is the reason. So you raise a good question, and it's precisely one of the reasons for the time bounding of our proposals. On consideration, I mentioned this in my tee-up, and I think you raise a very good question that it's important that we make clear in drafting, should the board decide to go ahead, that we would not want the effects of time value of money to prevent a lessee from being able to apply the exemption. So in answer to your question, it's absolutely the case that we had discounted cash flows in mind, and we would intend to make that clear, because I think the question you raised based on the wording was a fair one. In terms of timing of recognition in the P&L, in the table in the paper, just to say, we very purposefully didn't specifically answer that question, because all of these rent concessions are likely to be different. You could well envisage a circumstance where a lessor gives a 1 month rent holiday now, and in a month's time realises the pandemic is still in quite a significant place, and gives another month, and so on. And in that case, it would make sense to recognise them month by month. Equally, if there was an outright upfront forgiveness with no conditions attached, it might be appropriate to recognise it upfront. But in every case, it would absolutely depend on the particular terms and conditions. And I think if we tried to answer that question, we could do more harm than good by suggesting the accounting should be the same in every case. Finally, your question about potentially adding some a holiday onto the end of a lease contract. I'm glad you asked this, because I have, for the first time in my life in the last week, been accused of being too subtle. I've never heard that before. But just to make clear, because I think, as you say, it perhaps wasn't in the paper, that our intention would be that if all a company is doing is literally moving the identical lease payments, or lease payments, you know, adjusted just for the reasonable time value of money, to the end of the contract for a holiday that's happening now, we absolutely think that that would be within the spirit of the proposals. And again, we will look to make sure that that is not overly subtle in the drafting.
All right. Who else? Tadeu.
Thank you, Hans. Well, first, thank you very much for the team for having this paper ready so quick. I'm quite glad about adding the substantially to the drafting word, because I believe that that might be the case, especially when you don't have the involvement of the government. And then it's a negotiation between bank and clients. And of course, that it make a difference, because the quality of the credit may influence how it will take place. And then therefore, I'm glad with that. I understand the ring fence to 2020. I think that's something that we definitely need to try to make it simpler as possible. I just need one clarification in relation to the exemption. Many of you might not have this question, but just to clarify, when I read paragraph 20, 26, 30, and even the drafting, I was trying to understand, in case a company, let's say, have five contracts and got concessions related to COVID-19, can they apply the exemption to two of them and not for the other three? Just to understand how the requirement of the application of the exemption when you opt for that applies.
Catherine?
Yes, so we haven't mentioned this specifically in the drafting, because it's already covered in the standard. So paragraph 2 of IFRS 16 essentially requires companies to account for, and I apologise, I'm probably not using the exact correct words, but similar contracts that have similar terms and conditions in the same way. And we would expect that principle to apply to this practical expedient. So with groups of similar contracts, lessees would either apply it or not apply it. But if, you know, if they had two completely different sets of different types of contract, then they could make two decisions, if that makes sense.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye. And then Nick.
Thank you, Hans. Clearly, a number of industries were already facing some structural pressures ahead of the appearance of COVID-19. And it seems to me clearly that there'll be some considerable judgment required by those entities in terms of whether they qualify for the exemption or not, depending, you know, was this COVID-19 related, or did it already relate to something else going on? So that's a bit of a concern. But I think more broadly, I think it's important to remember that this will provide relief some preparers, and we talked about how, or we highlighted how it could impact many leases. But relief for preparers is cost for users, simplification for preparers is complexity for users. Users too are dealing with the impact of the new standard. And just because we don't hear from our user stakeholders, it doesn't also mean that they're under significant pressure at this time. So I think clear disclosure here is going to be essential. And so perhaps I could just first of all ask Catherine just to clarify in terms of paragraph 44. Here, my reading of it is that entities will be required to disclose whether they've used the exemption. How will users know the impact of the exemption in terms of, I'm particularly thinking about the forgiveness scenario. How will that be flagged in terms of the monetary impact of that exemption?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked this question. As you know, disclosure is my other favourite thing, along with leases. So I think it's a great question. Two things to say. The first is the existing specific disclosure requirements of IFRS 16 contain a number of particular items that need to be disclosed regarding P&L effects. So in the forgiveness scenario that you particularly asked about, lessees, as described in the paper, would generally be looking at variable lease payments, and the variable lease payment impact on the income statement is a required disclosure and so would be captured. In addition, and this was also highlighted very specifically in the recent educational materials, both IFRS 16 and IAS 1 require entities to disclose any sort of unusual entity-specific material information that users will need to understand the financial statements. And we highlighted this in the educational material as something that may well be captured by that. So if lessees have got any sort of significant rent concessions giving rise to this accounting, we would, you know, expect information and explanation about that to be captured by those requirements that we already have.
Okay. And I think that's very important, because I worry about this being tucked away somewhere in the footnotes. And potentially many users will not even know about this exemption. So I think while we may struggle to mandate that this gets the prominence that it deserves where it is material, I think what the board can do is commit to user education in this area, not around the discussion of the exposure draft, given the timescales we're talking about, but simply to ensure that users have an awareness that this may be impacting the entities that they are looking at, they're investing in today or potentially investing in, because without that awareness, this will just get lost, and that's not right. So I think we will need to come back and think about that. Thank you.
Anne, and then Gary. Anne, you're on mute.
Lots of the points on mute.
No, it's fine now. Yeah.
Thanks. Lots of the points that I wanted to raise were relating to scope, and I think they've been dealt with already. So let me ask about lessors. Some of the feedback that we got from Australia was that lessors were concerned that they were struggling as well, and could they have more education? And I know we've produced the education materials very recently. I just wanted to ask Catherine if you've heard anything else from other jurisdictions in relation to the lessor side of things.
I mean, to be honest, with regards to lessors, I probably couldn't articulate anything I might say as well as Sue did at the beginning of the meeting. So of course, what we have heard from stakeholders is that these concessions are happening, and of course, for every lessee that's receiving a concession, a lessor is giving that concession. So absolutely, we've heard that lessors are affected. However, our understanding is that the challenge for lessors isn't as difficult, for the reasons described in the paper, and also for the reasons Sue mentioned at the beginning, which I won't repeat. So, you know, whilst we have heard from a number of stakeholders since we posted the paper, we haven't heard anything that would change our minds in terms of the recommendation. We think it absolutely makes sense to give it to lessees. And as you said, we would absolutely highlight the educational material, which is helpful to both types of party.
Okay, thanks, Catherine.
Gary? Gary?
Can you hear me now?
Gary, yeah.
Okay, I'm getting a little bit of a delay here, and it part of it was on mute, but I'm also getting a visual delay. First of all, think, let me complimentary to the staff for turning around, and I think an excellent work product both last week and this week on short notice and responsive to the needs of our constituents. Just on the change on paragraph 31, about for no substantial change in the payments, I just want to reemphasize, as I think Tadeo did, maybe others, just how important that is, because it's these things are not necessarily managed as precisely on a day-to-day basis as banks do in processing loans. I think you could very well just have practical rounding differences. You could just do it to the nearest month end, all sorts of process simplification. So I think I just want to emphasize how important that seemingly small change, I think, is going to be in practice. And yes, you could get a little bit of an uplift in terms of total compensation, and you wouldn't want to knock out leases because it was the total value is £1 higher because it was higher. So I think a very good change the staff has done. I think in the short term, I mean, measured in days and weeks, I think this is as practical as much as we can do right now and provide substantial relief. Ian was on the same point on lessors. I think we're going to get pushed back. I don't believe, and I can speak from my own personal experience as well as some input I've got, it's as easy as the paper suggests. I think the lessors got the same issues that are out there. And I'm not suggesting we do anything now, but I think it's we're going to hear it that it's just as difficult for most lessors as it is for lessees, because their lease operation systems are different than lease accounting systems. They typically are different systems. Everything's in the operation systems, order entry, billing, pricing, collection. Lease accounting probably might actually come through a different system all too frequently. And yes, I think to the extent something is an operating lease, it mollifies this issue, but lessors actually want capital leases out there just because the profit recognition pattern. So I think there's more than we think. I think we're going to get pushback on it that we've underestimated the systems, we overestimated their systems capabilities. And I think we wait for it to come in, but I think we got to start thinking of another reasoning why we wouldn't do it other than we don't think you have a problem doing it. Thank you. Anyways, I do support getting the paper out as it is.
Sue?
Thanks, Hans. I just wanted to comment on that, and then I had one geek's point that I wanted to check with you, Catherine. So on the lessor side, if we get a whole load of letters from lessors saying this is hard work, that wouldn't be enough for me, just to flag that. And it's partly because, well, firstly, because there's lots of people who have got things that will be being hard to do under IFRS at the moment because of the current environment, and we're not going to, you know, address all of those. But also because I think for operating leases, I find it hard to imagine why it would be difficult. If it's a finance lease, and you've got something on your balance sheet where the value of the cash flows you're going to get in is now worth less, you've got a reduction in the value of an asset, and I'd want some convincing to believe that it wouldn't be appropriate to recognise that. So I think that's another consideration which is different on the payer's side, if you like. So just to flag that for any lessors who are listening. But my geek's question, Catherine, you'll like this one, but I just wanted to confirm the consequence of the retrospective application. And I completely agree with the idea of retrospective application, by the way, because I think that it provides the maximum opportunity to provide relief to lessees. So I think it's a very good recommendation. I just wanted to check, though, how that works for those who are in transition mode in IFRS 16. So if you're a lessee and you're transitioning to IFRS 16, and you've chosen to apply IFRS 16 retrospectively, if you had a modification of the lease, you would have needed to look at the discount rate at the date of the modification and work out your carrying amounts based on that. Am I correct in understanding that if they choose to apply this amendment and therefore they would say it's not a modification, that they would not have to update that lease if they were to apply this amendment retrospectively, so that that catch-up effect is removed.
Catherine, do you need to think about that?
Yes. Sorry, my brain isn't quite fast enough for your questions, Sue. Patrina, can you answer that one on the fly? Or
maybe if it's helpful, I can come in on it. So let's maybe I'll just try to picture a scenario. So let's say I'm somebody that has a March year end, and I've received some COVID-19 related rent concessions in March, and let's assume that I can apply this exemption because if we move forward and this is issued in May, I haven't yet published my March year end accounts, and I can take the exemption, and I decide I want to take the exemption. In that case, you wouldn't have, for those COVID-19 related rent concessions, I first of all wouldn't have to assess whether a modification and the accounting that would flow from that would mean I wouldn't have to determine a new discount rate. I would simply apply, the other words. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. So that provides a relief from one of the things I've heard some people are concerned about. If you've got this combination of you're at transition, you've chosen full retrospective application, and you might have to reassess the discount rate. So that's helpful, I think. Hans, Mary wants to come in as well, just while I've got the mic.
Yeah. Mary?
Mary?
Okay, Hans, thanks.
Mary?
Yeah. Yep, sorry, just having a problem with mute there. Just wanted to emphasize a few points. Overall, in agreement with the staff recommendation, I just want to flag some things that were important to me in it. First of all, subject to the substantially point that Catherine made at her TF today and Gary said, I think in this context, we should be focusing exactly on what the problem is. And so it's right to focus on downward, substantially the same or downward only, not just changes. And considering some of the other points, I also support the lessee only focus of this amendment. That's the issue that's been raised with us. And I take some of the cautions that Gary in particular has heard about, but I think we should focus on at this time on the problem that we've identified. Third is that the way I read the drafting in paragraph, the first sketch of the drafting in paragraph 31, with respect to the 2020, to it being a change, qualifying change is limited to those that affect the 2020 payments. If it affects the 2020 and the 2021 payments, for example, then rather than starting a bifurcation, I read it as you're out. And I think that's what the drafting that the staff has shown us says, but I just think we want to make sure that's clearly communicated, that we're not sending people down a bifurcation route. And I think it's right for us to take a time period-based approach to defining what we consider to be COVID-19 related or as a key characteristic of COVID-19 related. We are in a period of flux and a great deal of uncertainty. And one reason I have sympathy for making this change is that I'm not sure that we've seen all of the consequences work through. So I think the operational issue on top of last year's adoption by lessees of significant changes for IFRS 16, it's right for us to give a focus, for us to give some limited relief here, and I think the staff has struck the right balance. Something that I think we have to be attuned to when we hear back, even though it's a short comment period, is about having something that's immediately effective on publication. I think that's the right way to go with the exposure draft, but let's just make sure we get people to focus on that and see if we get any comments on that point. I think that's it. Thank you.
Is there anything, Catherine, that you need to respond to here, or?
No, I don't believe so.
No, okay. Then I Did I see Françoise? Yes?
Thank you, Hans. I very much support what the staff has recommended did here. I think it's a response to a well-identified problem, and it will have, if we all agree, will have be a very good response to the difficulties that people are encountering. Also support limiting that to lessees. I was convinced by the paper, but I think Sue expresses that even better. I support, I mean, the change that Catherine has already highlighted related to the effect of time value of money and the change in drafting from what is illustrated. I must admit that when I prepared, I would not have read from that drafting that the holiday would have been scoped in. So maybe it's because I don't read well enough. But maybe I mean, Catherine alluded to subtlety, and I'm certainly not subtle enough. And also, I think in the, and it's a question that I've seen raised already, to the point of whether this exemption would apply contract by contract. Catherine responded that the requirement of dealing with similar contracts in IFRS 16 would apply. I think it's better saying that loud, because the whole paper also very much emphasizes that we wouldn't want to deprive people from doing the right thing. So to me, it's not obvious if we are silent that dealing with similar contracts similarly would apply in this particular case. That's it.
Okay. Yes, Rika? And then Daryl.
Thank you, Hans. So first, I deeply appreciate the staff's effort to make today's vote happen. Thank you for preparing this very good paper to support our discussion today. And so second, I'm not a real supporter of creating some kind of the exemption in IFRS 16 because of the potential risk of the usefulness of the financial information should not be disregarded, as Mick mentioned, but existing challenges in the uncertain situation caused by the COVID-19 is widely spread. And I believe that the objective of this exemption is to provide a practical solution to the issue already people face right now. So in order to pursue this objective, I believe that we need to have a very good balance between the speed of whole standard setting process of this ED, if possible, to meet the March period end reporting deadline for an early application and the scope of the exemption, and also balance between the benefit of reducing the preparer's practical challenges and burdens and the sacrifice of the usefulness of the financial information for a user, especially in terms of the comparability and consistency. So considering the order factor I mentioned now, I support a direction of the staff recommendation explained in this paper. But I would like to suggest a few small points in the draft ED if staff can possibly consider before drafting it. The first is on paragraph 31, the paragraph X of the ED's draft. I think the extent of the consistent election of this exemption might not be so clear from this language. So it will be helpful if you can state a little more clearly. And another thing is also on the paragraph Y of this draft. And the others also said, but I also echo the language of the direct consequence might not be really understandable sometime, and then the entity need to apply some unnecessary judgment to distinct between direct and indirect consequence. So if possible, you can clarify a little further. And another thing on the paragraph Y is I don't disagree with the limiting time frame to apply this exemption, but especially when I consider the March year-end company's annual financial statement, it might be too mechanical, and then the financial information will not be so useful if the entity will select to apply this exemption only for the 9 months, first 9 months, and then they will have to switch back to the general requirement of IFRS 16 for the remaining 3 months in light of the exact same land concession. I'm just wondering if the entity can be allowed to apply the exemption to the same concession or and kind of the extension of the same land concessions consistently throughout the same fiscal year at minimum. And I also understand the disclosure requirement required elsewhere, but it's really good to include some additional work in the basis for conclusion of this ED. That's all, thank you.
Then I saw Daryl.
Thanks, Hans. So a couple of very quick points. I agree with the staff recommendation as it's set out in the paper, subject to the change on substantial. I think it's very important that we don't allow ourselves to be lured into the trap of throwing more and more detail at this, because I think that is going to substantially delay the process. And as Catherine, I think you said, one of the most important things we need to consider here is how quickly we can get this out, how quickly we can make it available. I'd also like to say that I strongly agree with what Sue said around lessor accounting. I think it's a valid point that there's a lot around this crisis that is going to make for difficult accounting decisions, difficult accounting judgments. But I think what we're dealing with here is degrees of difficulty, and there are a number of things that make lessee accounting in this specific circumstance so soon after we brought in a new standard particularly difficult. I don't think that applies to lessor accounting, and I equally don't think it applies to a lot of the other mumblings that I've been hearing about areas that are difficult to account for. So I'd be very inclined to agree with everything just as very narrow as this, and to give out a message that we don't see ourselves necessarily opening this beyond lessee accounting.
Who else? Jungwoo.
Yeah, just one quick comment. I agree with the Daryl's recommendation. Catherine, you did an excellent job about the quite short period. Just one question is, I wonder we can keep a kind of a good comparability between the American companies and our companies, because I wonder the FASB's Q&A step, Q&A answer, and our standard amendment looks like a kind of a different structure between these two things in terms of a kind of a authority of documents. But do you still expect that we are keeping the same practical expedient to our companies as to American companies?
So Chungwoo, if it's helpful, this is Patrina, I'll respond to that. And I suppose, Chungwoo, in response, I'll probably confine my comments more to talking about IFRS 16 and our work, which is, of course, where our expertise is. But I think at least that obviously we included in the paper some information about what the FASB staff has done and provided practical relief for rent concessions. And that was, you know, very helpful to us and in our thinking. And so I think overall, whilst I think the exact wording of how or these is slightly different from that, I think in essence we feel overall we'd be providing similar practical relief to lessees. And why do I say that? Because I think people you're providing relief to lessees from having to do the assessment of whether a COVID-19 related rent concession is a lease modification. And secondly, we are also providing relief that then for those rent concessions, a lessee would not have to account for it as a lease modification, and therefore, for example, could avoid having to come up with new discount rates in remeasuring the liability. So I think those are the two main practical relief sort of elements of the exemption for lessees, and I think we are capturing that as well as what was in the FASB Q&A document.
Any other questions before we vote? No? Can we vote on question one and two together? I sense broad support.
Hans, I'm a yes on vote. This is Mary.
Okay, thank you, Mary. That's all?
14. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And then the due process dimension, I believe, right?
Yes. So we'll move on to talk about questions 3 to 5. Just one important thing to highlight before the vote is that all of these questions are, of course, subject to obtaining approval from the trustees for the 14-day comment period. But on the assumption that we do get that approval, our questions are whether the board is happy with the 14-day comment period, whether you're happy that all necessary due process steps have been complied with as described in Appendix B of the paper, and finally, whether any board member intends to dissent.
Can I see whether everybody's happy around question 3 and 4?
This is Mary, yes.
Yes, okay, thank you, Mary. And Mary, you're not going to dissent?
Correct.
Okay. Anybody else going to dissent?
14 and then no dissent.
No dissents. Okay. Thank you very much. That's it for today then, right?
And well done to the staff. Yeah. I mean, incredible job
getting
this pulled together since last week. So well done.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well done.
Okay, guys. Thank you so much for this quick response. And we'll see each other on Monday, I believe, or Tuesday. Right.
Tuesday.
Okay. Bye-bye.